Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. I've come to Child Bereavement UK today to talk to Rachel Tegg, who's the Bereavement Services Regional Lead. And Rachel, you've very kindly shown me around your building. You have some wonderful facilities here for children, don't you, to help them express themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was only shortly before COVID that we actually moved to these premises. But yeah, it now means that we have more space and more family rooms, an ability to keep more activities and resources here. So yeah, it's a brilliant space to work with. We work with children, young people up to the age of 25 who have been bereaved of anybody important in their lives. But then we also work with parents and carers and immediate family where a child of any age has died as well. So that could be a parent in their 60s who's been bereaved of a child in their 40s. So it is very, very varied.
I'm particularly interested in the work you do with children because this place is full of things like teddy bears and sandpits and things. That must be wonderful for them to have available to them. Should we start by talking about the younger children?
Whenever a family initially come to us for support, we have an initial appointment, and in that appointment it gives the whole family, because we see them together as a family unit, it gives them a chance to get to know us a little bit better. We can talk through the different support options that we have, but we can also see how very young children sometimes cope in this space and whether this support is something that's right for them at the moment, or whether it's something where maybe instead of us providing support, we can work with the parents to provide something called parenting support. So we'll work directly with the parents to help them support the child at home. So there's no real limit as to the age of children that we work with. More often than not, we tend to work with children 4 years old and upwards, maybe 5 years old and upwards. But yeah, if ever it doesn't feel like the right time for a child, or it feels like they might need a slightly different type of support, we can either do that direct work with the parents, or we can give them things that they can try at home to support their child and help them understand what might be normal for them to be seeing in a child of that age as well. Because poor parents, you never expect a situation where you're going to have to support your child with a bereavement. There's no manual for it, there's no rule book. So all of the different emotions and behaviours that you see, you naturally you're going to be wondering, is this normal, is this okay? So a lot of the work that we sometimes do with families is just about educating and reassuring them of what behaviours and emotions are normal, what are they likely to see in their child or young person, what's okay, what might they need a bit more support with. And amazingly, the children that we work with are unbelievably insightful. So sometimes just asking them directly, what would you find most supportive? What are some of the things that you're looking for? How might we be able to tailor this support to suit you? Is the best way of going about things. And like you say, we have so many different activities and resources here. We quite often say that there's as many ways to grieve as there are people in the world, and everyone enjoys different things. They find different things interesting and engaging. And the more engaging you can make support, the better, because you're tapping into something that you know is going to be effective for that person. It's something that they're going to feel more involved in, something that feels right for them. So if we're working with someone not even just children actually, but if we're working with someone who finds drawing or art particularly helpful, then we can use that in a session if they like using imaginative play or they like to be quite tactile and use their hands, then we can use things like Play-Doh and clay and sand. So it's really about how is it that your mind works? How is it that your emotions work? And how can we tailor our support to meet your particular needs?
You show me some very lovely memory jars that you've got on the windowsill here. Can you explain the thinking behind those?
Absolutely. So the memory jars are a lovely activity that is focused on preserving memories. So what you do is you start out with a little empty jar and you pour out a few different piles of salt and you use different coloured chalks or soft pastels to colour in the salt. And you do that by sort of pushing the salt in circles, pushing the chalk in circles into the salt, and slowly it'll change the colour of the chalk. And then you can pour the salt into the jar in whatever pattern you like. But each different colour will represent a different memory of the person who died. It could be that you choose, I know, a pale yellow for the colour of their hair. It could be that you choose green to represent them taking you to the park. And we've had some brilliant colour requests in the past. We had hazel for someone's eyes, and we had to think, oh, how do we do that? And one little boy I worked with said, I want burgundy for the colour of someone's dress. So we had to mix together the red and the purple. But it's also an activity that a lot of the adults find really helpful as well. And particularly for people who struggle looking at photos or videos of the person who died, because sometimes that can feel very direct and very raw. Some people really struggle with looking at photos and videos. So doing something like a memory jar is a way of allowing them to spend some time with their memories, but in a way that's more comfortable for them. It's not quite as in your face as a photo or a video. That's something that they might want to work towards, but a memory jar is a nice way of having a visual representation of that person and those memories in a more comfortable way for you. And even just sort of the movement of rubbing the chalk into the salt and pouring the salt into the jar, it's very sensory. It appeals to the senses, and it also allows you to connect with those memories and those emotions in a different way as well.
What about the sand trays that I've seen dotted around here? What's the purpose of them?
I mean, there's no real end to how you can use a sand tray in support, but essentially it's, again, allowing you to try and process your thoughts and emotions in a different medium. So sometimes you might have a theme for the sand tray that you create. You might want to use a sand tray to represent a particular moment or a particular memory. You might say, okay, the theme of this sand tray is going to be my family and what things are like in my family at the moment. And you probably also saw in the other room, we have a nice tall shelf of what we call symbols. And symbols can be anything from little toy cars, little figure people. We've got some road signs that we use, shells, stones, leaves, plants. It could be anything at all that people can then place in their sand tray. And that individual item, the reason we call them symbols is because it might to somebody else look like a little toy plastic person, but that might represent something completely different to the person who's picked it up. And they can arrange their sand tray however they like, place their symbols however they want to. And it's creating a visual, physical representation of something that maybe in their head it was difficult to connect to, but actually by placing it in the physical world and in their tray however they want to, they're connecting with it in a very different way. It makes a different meaning to what it might have done in their head.
And do you find children talk to you while they're doing this? Is it a way of getting them to talk?
Some people talk while they're doing it. Other people don't. So some people might do their sand tray in complete silence, sit back and say, right, I'm done. And then we'll talk through it afterwards and we'll be able to say, oh, can you tell me about how your symbols are positioned? What's this one representing just over here? Other people will talk as they're placing things and they'll say, oh, this is representing this, that's representing that. I'm going to sort of put a sand tunnel in the middle, and that represents something else. So it really, really varies as to how people do their sand trays, even down to people deciding whether they want to be the one to tidy it up at the end, or if they just want to leave it how it is and then go after their session and just take a picture so that they can remember what it looked like. So it's very, very varied.
This is fascinating, all the things you do. The giant teddies, presumably just for sort of cuddling and sitting on, are they? Or is there more to them than that?
I mean, quite often just for cuddling and sitting on. Yeah, sometimes. I only found out the other day that the ambulance services sometimes have little teddy bears in their rucksacks for if they are having to attend an injured child, because just having that soft, comfortable toy there instantly brings a lot more comfort and calmness. So part of it is that as well. It's sort of saying it's okay to just be comfortable here. This is a safe place, because more than anything else, when families come to us, we want to make sure that they feel safe and comfortable, because how on earth are you supposed to talk about the most raw and painful experiences of your life in a place where you feel uncertain or unsafe? So yeah, it's all about creating an environment that says, you're okay here, we're here to hold you whilst you're going through this terrible time.
And I have to say that the rooms that you've shown me, they're all very comfortable with sofas and armchairs and play areas, and they feel like a family living room, don't they?
Absolutely,
really?
And sometimes we have to sort of ask ourselves what is comfort for us. So for me, it's absolutely tea, cushions, sofas and cosy blankets, which is luckily all of the things that we have here as well.
And you've got these amazing quilts. Tell me about those.
Yes, so these are our resilience quilts, and one of our practitioners, Pam, who's now sadly retired, she created them around a metaphor that she developed. Essentially, it's lots of very, very small torn up pieces of fabric and material, all different types of fabric and material, with stitching that goes through all of them and holds them together with a big piece of fabric backing on the back to mount it to. And what Pam described was that when you go through a bereavement, it feels as though you're torn into pieces, but then with the right backing and with the right support, you can pull those pieces together again and create something strong and beautiful. It's not how it looked before, it's not the same as it was before, it looks different now, but it's still strong and resilient and beautiful because you've had that support.
It is a lovely metaphor, and they're beautiful quilts, and they're used to describe just what you've described to me, are they, too, the families and the
children?
Yeah,
absolutely, because, I mean, Child Bereavement UK's tagline is rebuilding lives together. That's absolutely what it's about, because the grief is never going to go anywhere. You're always going to carry your grief with you. It's always going to have moments where it feels difficult or it feels painful. But the majority of what we do is all about helping people to live their lives alongside their grief and pull these pieces together again, give them the support that they need to make that resilient and strong, so that they don't need our support anymore. They can carry on living their lives with their grief still being a big part of it, but they are able to live their lives alongside their grief because they have these tools now, because they have that resilience. They know that they find talking or expressing their emotions in any way that we've done in support, they know that that's something that's been helpful for them. It's something they can always come back to. But hopefully they've got enough from support that they can now carry this on for themselves, and they're empowered to know that, yes, they're going to have the grief there for the rest of their lives, but their life is still going to grow around their grief and keep growing.
That speaks to me a lot, because I can remember the early days of grief thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get on with my life. I just don't know how I'm going to put one foot in front of the other. It feels like a huge black hole that you've landed in, and you don't know the way out, do you?
No, absolutely. Some people sometimes describe it like being in a very dark tunnel where you can't see the light at the end of it. You don't know how long it is. You don't know how long it's going to take to get through, or if you'll ever reach the end of it. And then ever so slowly you start to see that little bit of light, and it starts to grow and grow and get bigger. But yeah, I think it's quite often only in the second year of grief that reality of what's happened actually starts to sink in. People quite often talk about the first year of grief being so challenging. And then I think other people outside of that bereavement will then start to think, oh, it's been a year now, you should be feeling better. But actually, when that second year of grief comes and you start having the second birthday, the second anniversary, that is when that reality of, oh, hang on, this isn't going to change, that really starts to sink in. This is something permanent. So yeah, those early days of grief can feel incredibly difficult. That second year of grief can feel a bit like, oh, hang on, I thought it should be feeling better by now. Why hasn't it gone away? So yeah, like I say, such a big part of what we do is reassuring and letting people know it's all right, that's normal, that's okay. It's going to feel like this at the moment. Don't be too harsh on yourself. But also, there will be days in the future where it might feel very bleak or it might feel very raw. So let's have a think about, if that happens in the future, what are some of the things that we can do to make sure you feel supported, you feel as comfortable as you can be when this difficult thing is going on? I mean, they're surprisingly insightful, a lot of the children that we work with. And I think also one of the things so many parents and carers worry about is having these very open and honest conversations about grief, because they don't want to scare a child or they want to protect them. But actually, by having these really, really open conversations about grief and death and dying, first of all, children are surprisingly resilient. It's something new to them. They're learning about it and they take it in their stride. But also, it's quite often a bereavement is one of the first very significantly emotional, complicated experiences that a child is going to go through. So by allowing them to talk about these things, letting them know what's normal or not, and that everything that they're experiencing is okay, by going through coping strategies at this stage and by other things, you're essentially setting them up for how to manage other emotional events in future and how to build resilience and how to make it through a really difficult time. So even though it's so scary for some people to have conversations with children about death and dying and using that very concrete, direct language, you might worry about, am I going to upset or worry them? But actually, you're casting off any illusion or any space for their imagination to fill in the gaps with something worse, and letting children know it's okay to talk about these things. So when we talk about some of the models that we use with grief, like growing around grief and what it might look like in the future, the children we work with actually really take it on board. And by using metaphors or by using some of the storybooks that we use and some of the activities, the creative stuff that we do, it puts it in a way that they're able to relate to. And the other thing is, even if they're at an age where they don't fully understand what death and dying is, they at least know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that someone's gone away to a place that they can come back from. It doesn't mean that someone has gone to sleep and didn't wake up again. It doesn't mean that they are choosing not to come back. It means something very different. So by using that concrete language, to an adult, it sounds very harsh, But for a child, it's so important because it lets them know, okay, I don't know exactly what that is, but I know it's not any of these other things.
You've mentioned a few times normal, the word normal. You said that you can reassure families that what their children are going through is normal. Could you give me an idea of some of the things, some of the behaviours that families might see that they're not expecting?
Yeah, it's funny that I've used that word because there is no real concrete normal in grief and bereavement. I think the only thing that you can sometimes be sure of is that it is very normal to see a change in behaviour and a change in emotions. Quite often parents will come and say to us, is this normal? Is this okay? Or how do I know when to make a referral for support? And quite often what we'll say is, if ever you're worried or if ever you're unsure, that's the time to reach out and that's the time to give our helpline a call and just sort of say to them, this is what my child is doing, this is what they're exhibiting. Is this something that you've come across before? Is this something that other children, young people do? Same thing for adults as well. So many adults will say to us, is this normal to be feeling this way? And quite often the answer is yes. And even though it's hard to give exact examples of normal, what we can at least say to families is, actually, a lot of the families that we've worked with before have said something very, very similar or have been through something very similar. And they also didn't know whether or not it was to be expected.
I guess you're sometimes talking about children who might be angry, who are acting out, who are kicking against authority. And I imagine with teenagers too, that would be confusing for parents to know whether that was, quote, normal teenage behaviour.
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges sometimes is knowing, okay, what of this behaviour is just them being a normal teenager and what part of it is the bereavement? It's really, really hard to tell sometimes. And there's no concrete way of saying, oh yes, this element of their behaviour is the grief, this element is just they're going through a difficult and confusing time. And what you have to do in those instances is say, okay, well, we don't know exactly what's causing it. Maybe we don't need to know what's causing it. We just need to know what's going to be most helpful for them in this moment. We still need to keep boundaries in place. We still need to keep sanctions in place if there is any challenging behaviour. But we also need to introduce an element once they've calmed down or once things are more settled. There also needs to be an element of, okay, you clearly are struggling with something. How can we best support you with that whilst also having these boundaries in place as well? Because another element of the work that we do is with schools and with professionals and workplaces as well, doing training for them. And schools will quite often say to us, we have a young person who's been bereaved. What do we do in terms of behaviour sanctions? What do we do in terms of expectations with homework and stuff like that? And the best that you can ever do in these situations is to keep as much normality as possible, keep those boundaries in place and all of those sanctions in place, but with an added element of, we also know that you need support at the moment. If there are expectations to do a certain amount of work, then how can we work together to make that as manageable as possible for you?
Now you've raised the subject of schools. What do you do, or what do you advise schools to do about somebody who's been bereaved, who comes back into the classroom for the first time since they've lost a parent? How do you, or do you do anything to let the other kids know how to approach that person?
And I mean, the first and simplest answer to that is to speak to the family first. So when a family gets in touch to say that there has been a bereavement, it's so important that school and the family have good communication with each other. So having a really clear idea of what the child or young person has been told, what they need in terms of support, what the school is actually able to facilitate in terms of that. And it's so important as well for the child or young person to be a part of that conversation, because so many of the children and young people that we support say that one of their biggest experiences has been feeling like they don't have a voice, or that they haven't been given a choice or a say in their support, in funeral arrangements, in what happens to that person's possessions now that they've died. Quite often they might overhear conversations and feel, why am I not being included in that? Was my grief and my relationship with that person not as important as other people's? So any opportunity to give children and young people a voice or a say in things is so, so important. So by schools and other support organisations including the child in that discussion and saying to them, what would you find most helpful? What can we do in school to support you most? What do you want us to tell the rest of the class? It's likely that they will find out eventually from other parents talking or in the playground. So how would you like those people to find out? How can we do that in a way that suits you best? So it's about managing expectations, but also very much giving them a say in that support. Because if it's something that they feel they've been involved in and that they've had a say in, they're so much more likely to engage as well. Quite often with the families who come to us for support, where the parent feels it's very much needed, but actually the child or the young person does not want to come to us for support at all, we say to them, that's fine. We're here when you need us. If now's not the right time, that's absolutely fine. We can offer your parents some parenting support, or we can give you some things to take away that you can do in your own time. But if now isn't the right time for that support, we're not going to force it, because it wouldn't work. It would probably be very counterproductive. You'd be coming along to something that you don't want to be here for, so you're not going to get much out of it as a result. So it's so important to ask children, young people's opinions. Same with funerals and things like that. So many people call our helpline saying, do we take the child to the funeral? And our first answer is always, ask them, give them the choice, give them as much information as you can about what they'll see, what they'll hear, what's likely to happen, and then let them make the decision. Let them know that they can change their mind at the last minute if they want to, but it's so important that it's their decision, so that when they get older, they don't have any regrets, or they don't feel like that decision was made for them. So many children and young people tell us that more than anything else, they appreciate having been given a say in something.
And thinking about going back to school when you've just lost a parent, say, or a sibling, walking into a classroom, not knowing whether your classmates know that you've been bereaved, wondering what they might be going to say to you. I mean, I would have thought that was enough to put anybody ever returning back to school. Is there anything you can do to help with that?
Yeah, and I think, again, that's where those conversations before coming back to school are so important. So having that conversation between teacher or head of year and the child or young person to sort of say, what are some of the things you're worrying about coming back to the school? What are some of the things we can do to help with that? What do you want us to tell your classmates? What would you find really helpful for people to do? Do you want them to act completely normal, like nothing's happened? Do you want people to come up and ask you questions? Do you want them to say, I'm sorry to hear about the person who's died? And then teachers are then able to feed that back to the class. So you know that this person has died, and you know that they're coming back into school soon. This is what they've said would be really helpful. They're happy for you to ask questions, or they just want you to act the same as normal and they want school to be a bit of a distraction. And it's, again, managing some of those expectations, because so often people mean very well, but they don't know what to do or what to say. And because everyone grieves differently, what's helpful for some people isn't necessarily helpful for others. So that's why it's so important to be as much of an open book as possible. So feeling able to say to family and friends, this is what would be most helpful for me, or I'm more than happy for you to talk about the person who's died, or actually, I don't want to talk about it at all, and I just want you to treat me as you always do. And sometimes people very much worry about being that direct in terms of saying to people, this is what would be most helpful for me. But also some people also think, well, why should I have to tell people what would be useful for me? And unfortunately, just the reality is that if people don't know, they won't do it. They won't know to do it. So a big part of what we also do with families is working with them on how they can bolster and empower their own support networks so that they have that support outside of our sessions. Because we see people on a monthly basis, so much of the work is done outside of sessions. So you also want to make sure that that family has the support they need when they're not here as well.
So we've talked almost exclusively so far about the children that you see, whatever age, haven't we? But you see parents who've lost children as well, don't
yes.
you? And none of us can understand what that must feel like.
No, it's just unimaginable. And if people struggle with talking to children, young people about a bereavement, it's almost nothing compared to people not knowing what to say when you're trying to be there for someone when their child has died. Like you say, it is unimaginable. And a lot of the work that we do with the parents that we support, it's about, I guess, almost not just the loss itself, but all of the other losses that go alongside it. Because not only has your child died, but you've lost the future that you imagine for them. You're confused about your role and identity as a parent now. Like, do I still call myself a mum, or have I lost that now because my child has died? You lose friends and connections that you maybe made through NCT classes or other friends with children, and now you're not invited to the same events that you were before. So there are so many complex secondary losses that come after being bereaved of a child as well. And I think particularly within families as well, everyone grieves in such a different way. So two parents will notice that they grieve in very, very different ways to one another as well. So with the couples support that we offer, quite a lot of that support is just around how to manage that couple grieving in very different ways. How can we support them to grieve in their own way so that they can have some times when they're able to support each other, but in the times when they're not able to support each other, if both of them are having a really difficult time or if they struggle to meet the needs of one another, how can we make sure that they're still getting their needs met, but that they still feel like they can turn to one another when they're able to? And again, so much of it is letting people know that, again, to use that word normal, it's very, very normal for people to grieve in very different ways, and to notice you might be grieving at different paces or, yeah, just in a very different way to one another. That's okay. There's no right or wrong way to grieve. One person isn't doing it correctly and the other person's doing it incorrectly. You're just grieving in your own different ways. That's all right. And what we can do is discuss, okay, how can we make sure that both of your grief needs are being met, but that when that happens, you also have some time when you come together afterwards as well.
One hears that couples often separate after the loss of a child, don't they? And I guess that's part of the reason why. Is it because they're taking different grief routes?
Partly, but also grief is a life-changing experience, completely life-changing, and no one ever imagines that they will be in a position where their child dies. It's being tested to a point that you never ever conceived that you would be. No one goes into being a parent thinking that this is a possibility, that you'll be a parent and then your child might die. So it's the unimaginable again, really. You never think that you'll find yourself in this position, but you also don't know how it's going to change you and affect you as a person. Like I said before, everybody grows around their grief, but naturally you also grow and change as an individual as well. Sometimes people will find that they grow together, sometimes people might grow apart, and hopefully what we can do in support is show how people might grow and develop in very, very different ways, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to grow apart from one another. You can still grow yourself as an individual, but still have those times when you can come together as a couple as well.
Do you ever have grandparents here? I mean, when I'm thinking of grandparents, I'm thinking of three generations, say, all in one room together.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we
then
do,
you
definitely.
Must observe all kinds of different kinds of grief in one room.
Absolutely. And there are so many different factors that go into why someone might be grieving in their own unique way. Sometimes there are different factors that are cultural, sometimes they're generational, sometimes it's just the relationship that you had with that person, or even the circumstances in which that person died. So many intricate little factors that might change the way that somebody's grieving. So yeah, whether we're working with couples or grandparents or a whole family, a huge amount of what we do is helping them understand why they might be grieving in their own unique way. Because if the rest of the family or the other half of the couple can understand why someone is grieving in that particular way, it then becomes easier to not only accept that's just the way that person's grieving, but it also helps them to understand, okay, so something I thought was being supportive actually for that individual is the worst thing I could do, or it's just not what they will find helpful. So it also alleviates some of the tension and the pressure in that sense as well, because you're no longer having to guess what might be helpful for someone. It again makes you that open book so that people can see, okay, now I know what's going to be helpful for you. I don't have to constantly feel like I'm trying and trying to help and it's not doing anything. Now I know exactly what's going to be helpful, and yeah, I have more headspace and more energy to be able to provide that, because I'm not worrying about what might be causing you difficulty or what might be causing you pain. I now just know.
Rachel, you're so eloquent about all of this, I could talk to you for hours, but I'm going to put you on the spot now to finish with.
Okay.
You probably won't like this, but what, I mean, I've discussed with lots of people the different ways, the different things people say to you when you've been bereaved, and so many of them are unhelpful. And one of the things I hate is sorry for your loss, because it always sounds so glib and insincere. Have you got some good advice about a good thing to say to someone who's recently bereaved?
I think one of the best things that you can do is to just ask someone, what's the best way for me to support you right now? What would be most helpful for you right now? Is it checking in once a week to make sure everything's okay? Is it bringing food? I know I've had people in support before where they said, I had so much food brought to me and we had no fridge space. I didn't know what to do with it. So yeah, I think everyone, like I say, will grieve in their own way, and the best way to know what to do or what to say is to just ask, rather than worrying yourself, guessing or thinking, oh, am I doing or saying the right thing? But actually just saying to someone, what is going to be most helpful? I just want to know so that I can make sure I'm doing what's right for you and not just assuming what might be helpful. So yeah, I think that's the best thing that anybody can do to show that you're there for someone, is to just ask them.
And that's a theme really of running through everything you've said, working with children, teenagers, adults, parents, find out what they want.
Absolutely, because yeah, there is no generic answer to what's the most helpful thing or what can help someone through bereavement. It's so unique. Incredibly unique. And I think managing our own assumptions is something that all of us, even support practitioners, need to be conscious of. And it's all about that individual and what's going to be most helpful for them. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time and your energy if you're putting so much effort into something that's ultimately going to be unhelpful. So yeah, asking them and tailoring it to meet their unique needs, their interests, the way that they express themselves as an individual, whether that's through dance or music or sport or activities or talking, it's the best thing you can do.
Rachel Tegg, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you for coming.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.